talking about the battles and the scrolls. I didn't bring over the book from the other office now. Can give you the reference, though, of course. We're told that, remember, Mormon waves his banner and summons the people in Mormon 46 and 20, and summons the people to maintain this title upon the land, entering into a covenant with the Lord. Now, in the IQM, in the battle scroll, in column 3, line 4, to maintain their title upon the land, and they make a covenant, and they not only come under the banner, but they also sign their names. They all sign their names. So when it says they enter into a covenant with the Lord, they did that in Qumran the same way, the ancient Jewish practice. Remember, we're talking about the practices that were carried out in the early days before the temple fell. When the temple fell in the days of Lehi, that ended everything. See, the rabbis didn't like the temple. They didn't want it to come back. They went, the first thing they did, the learned men went and asked the emperor after Vespasian for permission to found a school at Jamnia across the Jordan, and he gave them permission, and that was the first rabbinical school. And the rabbis aren't priests. They teach the rabbinical learning, which is another thing. They don't have the rites of the temple anymore. So, but these people were the covenant people, and they signed up back in those days. And the people run to the banner in their armor in the 24th section, and they do that in column 4, line 6, the same way. When they rush to sign up, they put on their armor. They have to be armed, rending their garments in token or as a covenant. That's a very important thing, at rending their garments. This custom of rending the garments and the story of the two garments we'll come to presently isn't found in the Old Testament. See, in the 21st verse, they tear their garments. Now, there's recently an article by Jonathan Z. Smith called The Garments of Shame, in which he discusses this old Jewish custom of coming and rending your garments and putting them in a pile and stamping on them. And you say, may we be trampled on if we break our covenant. That's exactly what they do here. Remember, they do the very same thing. And so the Garments of Shame, you'll find that in the History of Religions. That's the journal, 1966, pages 224 following. So, but it's the same custom we have here. Again, it's not described in the Bible, but it's the old Jewish custom. Let me see here in 21. Yes, rending their garments as token or covenant that they would not forsake the Lord. Or in other words, if they would transgress, see, this is a mystery, what you call a mystery when you dramatize a thing and carry it out this way. Transgress the commandments of God or fall into transgression and be ashamed of Christ and take upon them the name of Christ, the Lord should rend them even as they had rent their garments. And in the way Smith explains it, Jonathan Z. Smith explains it, they trampled on their garments, and the next verse it says they trampled on them. And they cast their garments at the feet of Moroni, saying, we covenant with you. May he cast us at the feet of our enemies, even as we have cast our garments at thy feet. So the garments of shame are both torn and they're stamped on, the two things they do here. But the tearing of the garments is a very interesting thing here. Again, there's no mention, well, we'll go on with the story here. The rending of the garments takes us back to the garment of Joseph, when he was outcast and despised of his brethren. He tells us this story. Moroni tells us this. Alma, it is. Moroni tells us this story. And he recalls an old tale that was known to the Jews, that they knew all about it, you see. Because he says, let us remember the words of Jacob. You won't find those words in the Bible. Where does he tell these stories? Well, I'll tell you where he tells them. Just a second. Be patient. Don't leave. Let us remember the words of Jacob before his death. For behold, before his death, on his deathbed, he saw that part of the remnant of the coat of Joseph was preserved and had not decayed. And he said, even as this remnant of the garment of my son hath been preserved, so shall the remnant of the seed of my son be preserved. So this was the preserved part of the garment. And be taken unto himself, while the remainder of the seed of Joseph shall perish, even as the remnant of this garment. So half the garment perished, was rotten. The other garment was preserved. Shall be preserved. And had not decayed. Notice it says that even the part of the garment which had not decayed. And so he is both sorrowful and joyful at the same time. Behold, this giveth my soul sorrow, nevertheless my soul hath joy. Now there's a nice contradiction. He joys and sorrows at the same time. Now this is a classic. This is a classic statement here. So let's see what Thatlaby has to say. Now we have Book of Thatlaby here. We're very lucky to have it. I have the only copy I've ever seen. And though it's fairly popular, it's required reading in Muslim universities. I never saw another copy. I got this quite fortuitous circumstances. And this is by Thatlaby. The name is Fox. Now, when the Persians were converted to Islam, and they're the terrible the Shiites of today, the Sunni, they're the Shiites that make all the trouble. They were converted to Islam. Of course, they'd been fire worshippers before. And they knew nothing of the prophets and so forth. And Islam is based on the Bible, Old and New Testament, and all the prophets, Jacob and Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, are constantly mentioned in the Quran. But they never heard of them. They didn't know who they were. So the great Thalibi makes a famous commentary, and this is the accounts of the prophets, how to explain them. Thalibi, his name means fox. He died in the year 1036. So he made this survey at the end of the 10th and beginning of the 11th century, mostly at the end of the 10th century, so that the Persians would know what they were talking about when they read the Quran, who the prophets were and what they did. Where did he get his information? Well, when Jerusalem fell, both at the time of Lehi and then again in the time of the Romans, in the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, they go through the same routine again, see? As it tells us in the Book of Mormon, as Jerusalem has often fallen, often been restored, fallen and been destroyed, and then again has come back again. This is a routine. And after the time of the Romans in the year 70 when it fell, they fled, and most of them fled to the one safe place, the very tolerant and receptive Persian Empire. They fled to the Persian Empire at that time and were accommodated there. And so there they settled, and there you find settlements of the Jews. So what Thalibi did was to go out and visit these old settlements where he could find the old-fashioned Jews and ask them stories about the prophets. And they would tell him this, and he's very careful to document who his informers are. The son of so-and-so. Sometimes he'd go back 5, 6, 7, 8 generations to find out where this story came from. But this is what the Jews used to tell, you see, before the fall of the temple. This is the story, and this is the story one of the stories that Thalibi picked up. And it's very important. He's going to explain this story of the garment of Joseph here. So, the week, 10 days before the invasion of Normandy, which I knew all about because I was supposed to, I was the intelligence clerk for 101st Airborne. We had to be the first ones. I blew every penny I had at George Salby's shop on Great Russell Street, across the street from the British Museum. George Salby is a great big man who has this marvelous bookstore. He has no shelves. He just piles them on the floor like that, in great piles. He gets them in that way. He buys whole libraries, and he knows where every book is. Most marvelous. He knows. He can put his hand on any book in the pile. And two Arabists by the name of Howells and Ellis had both died within the month, and he bought both their libraries. And so I blew every penny I had, all my money that I'd saved in Claremont, to buy up. Well, I was like a kid in a candy shop, all these things that you couldn't get anywhere else. You see, it was marvelous, and of course, Thalibi just sent me spinning. And the interesting thing is, I gave him a check for everything I had. He trusted me, and 18 months later, when the war was over, he sent all the stuff to me, and not a single book was missing. He could have got away with anything, you see. He trusted me, and I trusted him, and perfect deal. I don't know whether I'd trust people like that today. I got it all. He sent me the whole library, and I haven't, except those I've given away. Well, he's talking here about this. It's about the chemise, about the shirt of Joseph and the two things. And this is what he says. And when Joseph made himself known to his brethren, he asked them about his father. What happened to our father Jacob? See, he's in Egypt now, and he was the important man. The brethren have been brought before him. And when he was brought before them, he asked them, what happened to our father Jacob? What happened to my father after I left, after I was no longer there? And they say, he lost his eyesight from weeping. Zahabat Ainahi, his two eyes went away. Oh, thank you very much. These are more of these, if you didn't all get one the last time. Brother Benson's talking in the Book of Mormon, very important. So be sure to pick one up before you leave. So he said, Jacob lost his eyesight from weeping for his son Joseph here. And then Joseph gave them the garment. He had the good half of the garment with him, because that's the part he clung to and still wore, you see. So Joseph handed them the garment. It's called a camisa. Our word chemise, chemise and so forth comes from that. The word is camisa that's used here. Amis is a camisa, the garment. So he gave them his garment. And now we talk about this garment. Vakana dalaka camiso min nestil jinnati. And this garment was the garment of the Garden of Eden. It had the weave. It said it had the pattern, the nest. It had the pattern of the Jahinna, that is the Garden of Eden, the garden. It's simply paradise. It's usually rendered just as paradise before man fell. And Kanafi, and it had in it the spirit, it had in it the breath of the garden. This is important. They believe that garments retain their odor. A person would come to you and say, you come from Cordoba, let me smell the air of your garments, that I may enjoy Cordoba. The idea that the air is more important than water with those. They always talk about the air of a place before they talk about the water. I guess because they didn't have any water, had varieties of air. But of Jahinna. And so that it never rotted. See, it used the word decayed. He saw the part that never decayed. And this garment, the half he had, was the part that said, never rotted, never decayed, and its threads never deteriorated. And that was its true state. It kept its true state. It says here, remember, he saw the garment. There were two parts, you see. The garment that had not decayed, the part of the remnant of the coat of Joseph which was preserved and had not decayed, whereas the other half shall perish even as the remnant of this garment that was decayed and rotten. And we hear about that one in a minute here. And that's which was not decayed. And he gave it to them, and Joseph gave it to them. Joseph gave that garment to them. Different syntax from ours. Joseph gave that garment to them. Mahuwa dalika kana elamira Abrahima. Now this is the important here. Kama Abrahima, and this was a garment that had belonged to Abraham. You see, the idea, the garment of colors and so forth, that's an invention. If you look up in your Bible, if you have a Bible, every time it mentions many colors, the word colors are always, even in the commentary, the garment the garment is always in italics because it's put in there by modern editors. It's found in no ancient source. It's not a garment of many colors at all. It's a garment of certain marks is the term that's used here. We'll see what it is in a second. But in this garment, he says, was a this garment had belonged to Abraham, and it already had a long history, what called Madakisti, and already its history was long lengthened. Because it went back to the Garden of Eden, you see. That's the garden. It's the only one, you see. Just as we treat the story of Cain and Abel, we trivialize this. We say, well, here Joseph was the youngest kid, so his father favored him and gave him a pretty garment of many colors. I say there's no mention in any source, ancient, of a garment of many colors. That's an trying to explain it, you see, of modern editors. And a rather trivial thing, but here it was the garment he gave them. It was the garment of the priesthood. No wonder they were jealous of him, that he, being the elder brothers at the youngest in the patriarchal line, you see, coming down from Abraham. This garment had belonged to Abraham, it says, and it's come down to Joseph instead of to the other brethren. And then you always get lost among all these little tiny things here. Yes, which had belonged to Abraham. And he said to them, Ithabu bikamisi, go with my garment. Well, be with garment hava. Go with this very garment, he says. Vakluhu ala wajhihi abi. And place it upon the face of my father. Vakuhu kazit tamit ala wajhi abi. And then come back. Ta'ata. Basiri, and his sight will return to him. It's a miraculous garment. Place it upon my father's face, and his sight will return to him. Get it. So they took it. And well, I haven't come to that yet. Atuni, and then come back to me and bring all the family with you. And so they did. This is when the Israelites went into Egypt. They brought Jacob back with them, you know, and the whole family came back to Egypt. So he says, then return all and come back to me. Remember the story of Joseph and his brethren. And when they had placed Egypt behind them and finally arrived, it means they turned their faces toward Canaan and had finally arrived there, their father Jacob said to them, Behold, I detect in this garment the odor. Reek is the same word as ruach. It's the same word as the English reek. You see, a reek is smell or an odor, and ricky is smoke. You see, ruach, rauch in German, of course, but they used to call Edinburgh Auld Reekie because it was a smoky city. They burned coal there. You see, Auld Reekie, it's the smoky. The same word we use. The Hebrew word ruach is the spirit, the Holy Ghost, ruach hakadosh. And the same word in Arabic, reek, it's the, always feminine. It's the wind. It also means wind. It means spirit. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's led to lots of controversy because when it talks about the reek, does it mean, for example, the story of Abraham in Egypt, an evil spirit has come, or is it an evil wind? The Jewish scholars don't like evil spirit. They don't like that, so they change it to evil wind. And it can be read evil wind, all right. But it obviously means, and they admit it, always means an evil spirit came upon Pharaoh. But here we have, if you don't, in the jiddu, it means I detect, I perceive, I note. He's blind, you see. The Riha Yusuf, the odor, the smell, the spirit of Joseph. If you do not think me out of my head from old age and a bit barmy, tafinu, tafahuna. You knew the ayif tafahuna. And then somebody else says, oh, it talks about the spirit that's in it, the east wind that has brought it, and so forth. And this is a very important thing. And when they placed it upon the face of Abraham, the face of Isaac, he smelt also the smell of the Garden of Eden. And finally, Imnuhu, Lysafi, and then he says, for behold, there is not in all the earth another garment that has that smell in it. This is a unique thing. It is the garment, you see. Lysafil Ardu, Min Riahi, Jinnati, for there is not in any other garment on earth of the winds of the Garden of Eden. Ilama kanamin zalik al kamisa, unless it is in this one garment, he said. So you can see why the brethren were so jealous. It was the garment. It was the garment of the priesthood. And then he says he perceives three, he knew it, it says, the commentator says, he recognized that it was Joseph's garment by feeling at first because it had three marks in it. As I say, when we talk about the, oh, we better come down to our text here. I thought it'll be here. Now the terms for I've told you that, the garment of many colors, what they translate as coat of many colors, is first tekonet, katonet. Our word cotton is related to that. Katonet, cotton shirt, a shirt, the Hebrews. Katonet, pasim. Now pasim, they say, it means it reached down to his wrists and his ankles. That's what it meant. What the Hebrew actually tells us, it was a pasim, means of adequate length. It, a garment which is pasim means a long garment which reaches down to the wrists and to the ankles. And quite different, you see. Pasim, there's no much color there at all of any kind. The Jerome, of the Vulgate, says it was a tunicum polymitam. And polymitums mean work very subtly with extra threads, extra markings. Works, polymitum means with many, polymitum means extra thread work, special embroidery, a special technique. And the Greek is ketona poikilon. And poikilon means tattooed, means also embroidered, it means elaborate work. The derived term is poikilon is of various colors. It means with spots or dots, but it means with marks on something. In every case it says he knew, but here it says he knew it because it had three marks on it. He recognized it from the marks. And of course, they couldn't have been colored marks because he was blind when he felt the marks. And he recognized it as being, as belonging to Joseph, to his son Joseph. Then Judah says, the Safa, Safana, La Safana, Yadhabu, Bechamisi, let me be the one to take the shirt. It was I who took the shirt, which was dipped in blood, Matlabacha, Bidami, which had been dipped. Remember, he took the blood, dipped in shirt, to Jacob. And it was I who reported to him that Joseph had been eaten by a bear, and that's what caused him such terrible sorrow, you see. Therefore, to atone for that, he says, let me be the one, I'm just so close together, to take the sound part of it. He asked Joseph. See, this introduces here, another source tells us that it was Jacob, that it was Judah, I get this right. Monday morning's an awful time. All the meetings on Tuesday. Sunday school lesson, priesthood lesson, fireside, all at once, and then no sleep. It was I who took this, the shirt that dabbled in blood and gave it to Joseph, to Jacob, and made him cry his eyes out. Therefore, it should only be right that I should be the one permitted, he says to Joseph, to take this soul, this whole part of the shirt to him, that his rejoicing in receiving it may be as great as his sorrow was in receiving the other. Wasururuhi badi al-chazni, and sorrow would follow, and joy would follow sorrow. Notice in the same sense that his sorrow would be, his joy would be as great as his sorrow was, and joy would follow sorrow. And as he says here, and he says, behold, it giveth me sorrow, nevertheless my soul hath joy. See, joy follows sorrow. It's the same story here he's telling here. And the only person that reports this anywhere is Thotlebi. You won't find it in the Talmud, you won't find it in the Midrash or the Mishnah, and you won't find it in the Bible. Where did Joseph Smith pick it up? He tells us it was an old story familiar to the Nephites. He says, let us remember that. He says here, not only let us remember, and he says, you really call the words of Jacob when this happened. His soul has sorrows. So he's telling us the same story here. Now let's see what he left out here. And it's the rending of the garment, too. Oh, the garment was rent. There's no tradition anywhere that the garment was rent, except there's except the Arabs again have it, a famous story. A student was working for a master, as an apprentice, and they said to you, does your master feed you well? Does he care for you well? And then he says, verily, if my master owned a house full of needles, and Jacob came to him and begged for him the use for a needle for 1 hour that he might sew up the torn garment of his son Joseph, he would refuse to lend it to him. That's the kind of a man I'm working for, you see. But the point is, it takes for granted the torn garment that Jacob wants to sew up, that Joseph's garment was torn in two parts. And one part was spoiled, and it never rotted. And it belonged to Abraham, and it went back to Adam in the tradition. It was the garment of the garden, and it had the marks on it. That's why Jacob recognized it, and that's why the brethren were jealous, obviously. It was the greatest favor he could possibly give him. So this is a great thing, you see, and here we get something in the Book of Mormon that really sews things up. And then it goes on to his dialect with death, because he says, and all this happened on Jacob's deathbed. And it says here, yes, it is a dialogue between Jacob and death, which is a very important one, incidentally. It has to do with another subject. I have to be writing on at present. But he says, let us remember the words of Jacob before his death. For behold, he saw part of the remnant. It's exactly the same story. Part of the remnant of the coat of Joseph was preserved and had not decayed. It uses the very words here, was preserved and had not rotted. Ballatiya wala alahi sakim. And there was no sakim. Sakim means a weakening of sickness, a weakening of fiber, a breakdown of any kind of sakim. And had not decayed. And he said, even as the remnant of my son have been preserved, so the remnant may be taken to himself, shall perish even as the remnant. And then he makes this comparison. And so we have, and also the people come running. This is the other source. You see the people come running, rending their garments, putting them in a pile, standing on them. Well, there's Jonathan. Smith's article, which is the fifth volume in 1966. The first person to notice that, you see, was in 1966, the importance of this treading on the garments. All these things are here, these old Jewish customs. And then he says, don't get the good guy illusion here because of this. He tells them, remember in the 25th verse here, the remnant that perishes may even be our descendants, even ourselves it's talking about. Don't think just because we're not Lamanites that this doesn't apply to us. He says the remnant may very well be ourselves. And where he says, and then, yes, the 27th verse, the remnant which shall perish have descended from us, yea, even it shall be ourselves, if we do not stand fast in the faith of Christ. Now, then, The banner is the type of the nation, as you saw before. The type of Joseph's garment was the garment of Kavi and so forth. And the garment had two parts, and joy, he had the joy and sorrow. You see, we just recited. And remember the words of Jacob, and he says, remember, in the 26th verse, he says, now behold, this was the language of Jacob. So they had the written document. It was among the brass plates, probably the bronze plates. They had the written down because he says, we know the language, and, well, that was the story. That's the way, remember, language is used always in the Book of Mormon as the speech, as the listen, as the lip. Calls it an old story. Known as, he says, let us remember the words of Jacob. And he starts out, let us remember the words of Jacob. And he ends up by saying, now behold, this was the language of Jacob. They had the record. And then Amalickiah in the 30th verse makes the standard move, you see. The dissenting parties seek support in another country, as they do today, for example, as Cuba seeks support from the Soviets, as Pinochet seeks support from us. They divide that way. North and South Korea, one seeks support from China, the other from United Nations, mostly United States. And, of course, in ancient times, Hadad, when Jacob's general Hadad went down and conquered Arabia, the Nedge down there, Joab, the terrible Joab, he went down and conquered, and it was Hadad who was the ruler. He was the Arab prince down there. He went over, fled to Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter, and that Pharaoh was the one whose other daughter married married Sheshonk, who was the Pharaoh Sheshonk, whose other daughter married King Solomon. And of the three buildings Solomon built, the three greatest buildings were the temple, his own palace, and the palace he built for the daughter of the king of Egypt. And she married him, and they were both sparring to get Egypt support, you see, in this division. So Hadad, when he caused the trouble, he went and married another daughter at the court of Egypt and started stirring up trouble for Solomon here. So this always happens. You go and make an alliance with a stronger nation, then there's trouble. Amalickiah, in the 33rd verse then, Amalickiah skips out. It's too much for him. Notice he is in he's in the minority, definitely. And it says people don't like him anyway. Notice the 29th verse. He saw that people were actually, he saw that his people were doubtful concerning the justice of his cause. He hadn't convinced them completely, you see. It came to pass that when Amalickiah saw that the people of Moroni were more numerous, so he wasn't the popular party anymore, and that his own people were doubting it, you see. See, he got the message, and he skipped out. He's an opportunist and a very shrewd man, you see, what he's going to do. Moroni thought to cut off the people. He didn't want them. The one thing he didn't want them to do was go and join the Lamanites, of course. This was a standard procedure, as we see, go get the stronger and stir them up. The Lamanites were more fed up on war than the Nephites were. They didn't want any at all because they'd lost it to Moroni. And he knew that he would, Moroni knew that he would stir up the Lamanites to anger. He didn't succeed in doing that, but he got the king on his side, and then the king started stirring things up. Then all he had to do was bump off the king and take over and see what happened. A typical plot, and cause them to come to battle against him. So if Amalickiah goes out and gets the Lamanites with him, we're going to be in real trouble, and that was very alarming. Therefore, the only thing he could do, he says, was to march out and cut off the course of Alma in the wilderness as quick as he possibly could, while he's still in the wilderness, before he's made contact with the, before he's made contact with the Lamanites. And it came to pass that he did according to his desires. And he skipped out with a small band. He wasn't able to get away. They were cut off. He skipped out and fled with a storm, with a small band. And mind you, Marcus, people like that. We have dictators do this all the time. What do you do with the rest of them? The ones that had surrendered, he had cut off. The real troublemaker and a small number of his men, they got up over and they did join the Lamanites. But what was Moroni? Now, Moroni had plenary power. He could do anything he wanted during this crisis, you see, until the issue was settled. And we're told that Amalickiah's own people were doubtful, see, at that time, were doubtful as to the justice of their cause. So they're not going to make much trouble. They're going to surrender willingly, and they do, you see, because they had doubts all along. Only a few held out, and they were still the enemy under arms. They refused to make any concessions at all, you see. So the battle went on as far as they were concerned. They continued fighting. He wasn't slaughtering prisoners of war or executing them or anything like that. He was just continuing the battle, as he does later with Zerahemnah. And so he does it here. The battle would continue until the opposition was stopped. Whoever wanted to stop, he says, was free to do so. I say this was not the killing of prisoners of war or anything like that. Who would not enter into a covenant to support the cause and see they were still, in other words, if you don't surrender, if you don't sign the surrender, you're still in war. And he caused them to be put to death, and there were just but few who denied it. They were out. See, the point is, they were out to rouse the Lamanites and had only to surrender to be free. Only a small number still held out. But it was a very dangerous situation. He took this desperate action. And they did overwhelm those that were overwhelmed. But I say, all you had to do was drop your sword and you're all right. They wouldn't do it. And then he planted the standard of liberty on all the towers. And question again, is he forcing people to be free? I used to say Ernest Wilkinson was going to write a book on free agency and how to enforce it. He was doing that time. But what he did give them was peace. But it only lasted 4 years, and then all hell broke out again. See, it was not a permanent peace. Things are still very tense here. The Constitution of Benjamin and Mosiah guaranteed absolute freedom of speech and opinion, and so they were able to continue here with much peace and rejoicing. Now we have an extremely interesting note here. On the next chapter. There were some who died with fevers, which at some season of the year were very frequent in the land, but not so much so with fevers because of the excellent qualities of the many plants and roots which God had prepared to remove the cause of disease to which the men were subject by nature of the climate. It tells by nature of the climate there were certain diseases, especially fevers in the land. They were able to get the best of by many plants and roots. You notice how desperately we're searching now in the jungles of Central and South America for roots. We know that there are thousands of possible remedies that are disappearing every day, as every 15 seconds, they say every 15 seconds, a new species of plant disappears forever. And the way they're cutting down those forests there at tremendous rates just to make grazing land for McDonald's. And that's where the meat goes, isn't it? But notice the Book of Mormon, how it's ahead here, the fevers and so forth. The plants and roots, notice the plants and roots which God had prepared, they could conquer the fevers, the excellent quality of the... Not much so with fevers, they were able to control fevers. See, not so much so with fevers because of the very good remedies they had from these plants, these tropical plants. And quinine wasn't discovered until 1840. Nobody knew that the quinine bark would cure these fevers until then. They didn't know what could cure them. Of course, they didn't know about mosquitoes or anything else. But it was a subject, again, here we have a wonderful insight. These occasional flashes of background in the Book of Mormon, which for the most part concentrate intently on the issues of salvation. But here it just happens to note in passing, it's good to note, see, it was fever country, diseases to which men were subject by the nature of the climate, which was tropical and humid. You get that obviously. And it says especially fevers, which they held under control, the most excellent quality of the plants. Now, consider the astonishing wealth of evidence in this one chapter here. And the question immediately arises, can Joseph keep up the pace? I mean, we could have spent the whole semester on this chapter, all these things. But can he keep making so many bullseyes one after the other? I mean, things that nobody would have guessed, I mean, back there. As I say, quinine, the sovereign remedy, the first to be discovered was in 1840. Didn't even have. But they know all about this in the Book of Mormon. They know that it's tropical, and they know what to do about it. And I say today, for the first time in the last 10 years, we're suddenly beginning to realize as those tropical forests go, we'll lose probably the best remedies possible to many diseases that we're not on today. They talk about curing AIDS and all sorts of things. If we can only have time to test the numerous plants, roots, as it says, roots and plants. And of course, the roots are famous and the rest of it. Now, we go on to, now we have a very important thing. Yes, it's very important to mention this here. We're in this chapter, we have mentioned in the Book of Mormon, four different cultures, four sharply marked cultures in the Book of Mormon. They're hostile to each other. They're all related and so forth. I'm going to list them this way, though. First of all, you'll find the Brotherhoods. We'll call them that. Now, these are very ancient societies that you'll find from the earliest times. And the first, I'm going to call the Brotherhoods. They call them that. That's what Santayana calls them, for example. the Brotherhoods, remember, that Newton identified himself with it? I'm going to put it in quotes. This is the first kind, and you recognize them in the Book of Mormon. I say they flourish. They're the Rechabites. Remember, the Rechabites, the goal of the people that flee out in the desert, but they don't flee just for disorganized, just to become desert wanderers or food gatherers or anything like that. They're organized, and they form a close society. And, of course, this is Lehi himself and Nephi and Mosiah. They leave, and Nephi, remember, leaves when as soon as they land in the New World, goes out. But they're very well organized. They build a temple. They keep the ordinances and so forth. They're a brotherhood, brothers and sisters. It tells us how they lived, and it describes their act by the waters of Mormon. It describes the waters of Mormon so beautifully, and then there's ecstatic passage about the waters of Mormon, and there's just such a passage in the scroll about the beauties of the place where they went out to settle, and they... And it mentions the trees that grow there, the groves, how beautiful are they, remember the waters of Mormon, it keeps repeating, and the trees of Mormon and so forth, because there's salvation there. And the people of Ammon the same way, the people of Ammon very well organized, certain print, they're living the gospel, they're living the gospel itself. There are subdued minorities that are described in the Book of Mormon, they never dominate in the Book of Mormon, as the humble followers of Christ. Remember, there are always a few humble followers of Christ. Well, you find these everywhere. You find the Egyptian phyli. The knowledge of Egypt is not general, it was not known to them, it was always reserved to the phyli of priests, certain groups of priests, the Sau, they call them the Sau. Well, a beautiful example of that is from the tomb of Petosiris. As I say, in that passage, you'll find a couple of dozen passages right out of the Old Testament. Yet it's way back earlier than... they won't accept that. Lefebvre, who made a thorough study of Petosiris' tomb, said it was just a coincidence. Just a coincidence, they talked the same thing. But the fact is, the Egyptian priests were organized, you know, And the knowledge is secret. There are things, they have ordinances in which you enter. It's not all secret. They preach the gospel and so forth. But there's certain knowledge they keep to themselves, and they don't shout from the housetops. And this is the knowledge that you get. Incidentally, each of these four kinds, I have written more than one article on each one in Gentile journals. And on this one, I would certainly say the 40 days, the 40-day ministry, Evangelium Quadriginta Diarum, study in the Revue de Qumran, on the Qumran Society, is just such a society. And then we have other cases, the 40-day ministry of Christ. See, when Christ came during the 40 days, after the resurrection, we're told he taught the apostles in secret. He taught them in secret before, remember? He says, they say, why do you speak to us openly? He says, you speak to all the rest of them in parables. Why do you speak to them in parables and speak to us openly in the clear? He said, because to you it is given to know the secrets, the mysteries, he says, of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it is not given. It's a closed society with these instructions. They are the brethren. He said, they call each other brethren and sisters and so forth. They're the humble followers of Christ. But we have these same societies existing throughout the ancient world. The Egyptians are a classic example here. The Hermetic societies, they are hermetic, is what they are. This is the word that goes back. You'll find just how old are they, much debated about. But our word hermetically sealed, you see, hermetic, because Hermes was the Egyptian Thoth, and in the beginning he taught the books of wisdom and so forth, and the secret societies were formed around him of holy men and the hermetic literature. The hermetic literature appeared very suddenly in the 16th century, in the 15th century, actually, and got the Europeans all excited. And they thought, this is Hermes, this is the old knowledge that goes back to the beginning. And then in 1613, Casaubon showed that it was a production of the Christian period, probably. It wasn't the first or second centuries. It wasn't ancient at all. But now we know it was ancient, because it just picked up an ancient thread and elaborated on that. This hermetic, you'll find hermetic societies all doing about the same sort of thing. It means going back to Hermes, going back to the original wise man who taught in the beginning. And I have the whole book of the hermetic writings, and they teach things that are very familiar in the gospel. Nothing strange about them. Then along with that is the Orphic societies. We have the Orphic gold plates, for example. It looked very much like the Nephi story, like Lehi's story. The Orphic gold plates, Brother Griggs, Wilford Griggs wrote an article about that. The gold plates. And of course, we all know about the Pythagoreans. Now, the Pythagoreans, remember, they lived in sacred communities. They gave us the Pythagorean theorem. They studied the cosmology. They all studied these things, and they dressed in white, and they had common meals, and they lived with their families there. There were sacred societies, and they inspired the rage of all the others living around them, and were exterminated. They were persecuted and exterminated for that reason, because they lived in the wealthy, lavish society of Magna Graeca, of southern Italy at that time. And then there's Plato's Lyceum. But see, it's always this idea, a group of philosophers, of men in the know, those understanding, those who have been initiated. I mean, if you don't understand what they're doing, if you're not in on it, if you're not interested, you can't be initiated, because you wouldn't qualify, you wouldn't want it, you don't know anything about it. But the church was that, saying, oh, yes, a good example about that is the passing of the church, that article in the church history. And then I would say that's a better example here. See, that passed away. See, the church never recognized it. The Catholics say that the gospel had to be preached from the housetops. There was no initiation. There were no secrets in the early church at all. Well, don't fool yourself. There were all kinds, of course. The Lord was constantly. And then I say, after the resurrection, he came, and then he taught them. And for the first time, they knew what he was talking about. And they organized, as he told, and then it says, and remember, both in the Book of Mormon and 3 Nephi, and in at the end of Mark there, he told them, beginning with Moses and the prophet, he laid all the scriptures open to them. Then for the first time their eyes were open. Then they understood for the first time. This was after the resurrection. We don't have a word of the sermon he spoke. He taught them, you see. But any time you find a very early Christian writing, it's almost bound to begin. I collected them in this Dutch publication, the Revue de Qumran. Oh no, that's the Companions of the Cave. They always claim to have, you'll find, this is the secret teaching that Jesus gave the apostles after the resurrection. This, we have that knowledge, and the people that have that knowledge call themselves the Gnostics, the knowers. You see, our word know, the same way, K-N-O-W, this is G-N-O-W. They're Gnostics. So Gnostics are this kind. They're fake hermetics. They're fake brotherhoods. They did everything to fake. And of course, we have a great literature. See, the second century is the century of heresies, not the century of enlightenment. Epiphanius has listed 88 sects of that time of Gnostics. They're each one claiming that it was the original church founded by Jesus, and it was based on the knowledge that he gave the apostles after the resurrection. That secret knowledge, they were the Gnostics. But this recognizes the existence of the brotherhoods always, you see. And then there's the seven wise men. You go back to archaic times, the idea that there were seven wise men, the secret, they came together once every so often, 7 years usually, and compared notes and so forth, and then they went out seeking and spreading wisdom, spreading healing throughout the human race, and these were the Sophoi, the wise men that traveled, and they're connected with the seven sleepers of Ephesus. They formed a sacred society, and Qumran is mixed up with the sacred society, because many people claimed that they were the seven sleepers. You see, they fell asleep in a cave, you see, and slept for several hundred years and then came alive again. And that Qumran is the seven sleepers. And today, they actually, I say, in 1964, I went out to Rakhim, south of Amman there, with Anita Jani, who was the head of archaeology for Jordan. And we visited this settlement of Rakhim. It was just like Qumran. They had everything there. But I went back later, 10 years later, and what had happened? They had built a huge mosque there, reinforced, building it. They have changed the whole thing, and they say, this is where the seven sleepers, the original seven sleepers, are here, and they've made a great Muslim shrine of it now. Shows how you can make a holy place overnight like that. They've invented the whole thing. These are the seven, but they're called the seven sleepers of Ephesus, so I don't think they'd be the seven sleepers of Palestine. They're the seven sleepers of Ephesus. Well, I wrote a long article on that in the Revue de Qumran, as I say. And so it goes. And then you have this, among the Muslims, you have the same society. They're the Sufis. And then you have Abraham. Remember, Abraham had such society, the 318, which he circumcised and took into the covenant. You couldn't be a follower of Abraham unless you were taken into the covenant. And he founded, you see, established, supposedly, but the Kabbalah, Kabbalah is very important. You can spell it almost any way you want. They usually spell it with one L today. But Kabbalah means to receive. Yet what you received back from Adam, that it was the original knowledge, the gospel preached by Adam, then handed down through Noah, through Seth, to Abraham, through Enoch, to Abraham, and right down to our times. And this is called the Kabbalah, the received knowledge that went back to the beginning. And of course, it's very, they form themselves into closed societies, very secret, very advanced knowledge. They study astronomy mostly. That's what you get in the book of Abraham, as Kabbalah. And in the East, in the West, they flourished as the Khazari, the Bogomilians, the Waldensians, and so forth. It's very interesting. When I was on mission, I was in the Black Forest most of the time, and I came upon a man in Durlock who said he was one of the Waldensians, and he asked me would I go up and visit their people. They lived in a little village called Pinache, way out of the way. Even the bus didn't go there. And they were, all the names in the cemetery were French and so forth. And there were Waldensians who fled in the 13th century and lived there ever since. But they claimed to be a brotherhood, and that's why they were driven out. They claimed to be the brotherhood. We have these societies in Europe, a book that has been caused quite a flurry recently called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, by Lincoln and by three English BBC investigators. Goes into that particular subject. You can get it in the bookstore. And then there were, flourished in modern times, utopian societies that tried to get back to that. In society in America, they reached their peak in 1840s, and there were half a dozen of very much like the church. In fact, it's the 50th, 51st, around there, section of the Doctrine and Covenants deals specifically with the Shakers. They were one of those groups, you see. A recent volume of the Jew. Oh gosh, of the Geographic magazine on the Shakers. They reached their peak right in 1840 and 1850. And one of the members of the church had been an active Shaker, and they were sent. Remember, the brethren are sent to the Shakers to preach them the gospel. Say, but don't let them preach it to you. Well, today there are 12 members left of the Shakers. They still have their society. They ate at the common table. They had all their things in common and so forth. They had all these idealistic ways, and they believed they had to live in complete chastity. Therefore, they never married. But that wasn't why they dwindled away to nothing, because they grew very rapidly and were very popular when people wanted to retreat and join and finish their lives with them and so forth. That didn't stop it. They just withered up, was all. So many of these and others, like the Amana Society, little things that are rather picturesque today and so forth, and the Owenites, and various model communities in the New World and New England and so forth. The first spiritualists started out, as a matter of fact, in the same way. Started out in Maine, and then they moved to Rochester, New York, right near Joseph Smith. And within 10 years, they had 10 million members. And today, there's nothing left of them. It's an interesting thing, the way these things carry on. But they tried to be these secret societies. The most interesting was Jung Stilling in the 18th century. A man called Jung Stilling, he got 3 million acres of land from the Tsar Alexander I of Russia. To grant his people, and they got themselves covered wagons in the end of the 18th century. They started migrating. The 3 million acres were in Bessarabia on the eastern shore of the Black Sea. It was good land and so forth, and they started to go there and make their pioneering. He was going to find the new Zion, and all this talk about Zion and so forth. And on the way, he had a vision that told him that was not the place. They would have to go back. Another people would do it later. They would go in the opposite direction, but they would be led by a man with his name, Jung, see? And so that ended the movement. He became a very famous, you might call him a mystic at the time. So that you, but in even in primitive societies, you have fratries and you have clans. They're divided. See, the Hopis are divided into the antelope clan, the snake clan, the bear clan, so forth, the turtle clan. And they have their secrets and their initiations and so forth. They're brotherhoods. You find these brotherhoods everywhere. And then you find monastic movements. You find, beginning with monasticism in the 4th century, with St. Pacomius, and naturally St. Anthony, and then going to Cluny, and then going on to the Cistercians. They become rich and powerful, but they're closed societies of brotherhood, living together, sharing secret knowledge and initiates and so forth. And then following after Lehi's time, Lehi was a contemporary with the Buddha. Everywhere you have Buddhist monasteries all over the East, as you know, the monastic movements of the Buddhist brethren. succeeding the Bane or the Lammas, brethren. The Lammas were earlier, but they're all the same thing. They live in these great monasteries. They live the life, and they think they're living the life of angels, heavenly existence, and so forth. So they're the brotherhoods. You find them Christian, you find them Buddhist, and you find the Sufi among the Muslims, and so forth. So this is our type one, the brotherhoods. The other types, it does exist in the Book of Mormon. They always do. We want to consider the others because it has a relevance.